everybody. I'm Mark Levin, Director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and I'd like to thank you for coming to this joint briefing of the Texas Public Policy Foundation and the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition. And I would like to turn it over to TCJC now to welcome you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Leah Penny. I'm with the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition, and I'm actually not going to be presenting. I'm sort of providing a little introduction to Ana Yanez Correa. Unfortunately, she just stepped out to go provide testimony. Sorry, it's how it goes. I wanted to also mention that we've got, first of all, thank you, everybody, for being here. It's great to see a packed house. This is great. We've got other members of our team here. Erica Serpernot, many of you probably know her, and she helped put together this presentation. And then Chris Cunico and Travis Lateef from our office, you may be speaking to them about any questions in this presentation, and you may be talking to them about potential legislation. I don't know. I also wanted to mention we've got some really wonderful people here in the audience. We've got Carrie Wellebaugh from CJAD here. She's the director of CJAD. And we've got Judge Cosper from Harris County, and we also have presiding Judge Sharon Keller here, Chief Justice, and Dee Wilson from the TDCJ Reentry Division. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yay! Great. And I'm sure there may be other people here that have a strong interest who are representing agencies here. If anybody wants to introduce themselves, please.
Oh, well, I'd like to recognize also Representative James White, who's here, one of our great new legislators. And are there any other lawmakers or elected officials? Our Director of Parole, Brissy Owens, so hopefully she'll be back. And I'd also like to recognize Macron Reddy back there, who works with me at the Texas Public Policy Foundation on criminal justice and on our Right on Crime initiative, which y'all may be familiar with, which is rightoncrime.com, where we're making the conservative case nationally for criminal justice reform. So, without further ado, let me go ahead and do my presentation, and then hopefully Ana will be back to present hers as well, and we do have some handouts at the back also. And as you all know, we're facing a challenging session, but I wanted to review some of what Texas has accomplished, both in reducing crime and controlling costs over the last several years, thanks to many of you in this room, and then talk about the path ahead. So, of course, one of the questions people first always ask me is it always necessary to increase incarceration in order to reduce crime? And this is a table that I think is useful to look at. This is actually really reflects the period before Texas started making many of the changes that it did. But it shows from 2000 to 2007, four states, California, Florida, New York, and Texas. And you can see that New York had the greatest reduction in crime and also the greatest reduction in their incarceration rate. And Florida had a big increase in their incarceration rate, but they reduced crime significantly less than New York. Crime has been going down in this country for 17 years, which is great news. But some places have been more effective than others in reducing crime. And New York City, of course, is an excellent story. From 2000 to 2007, 64% decrease in violent crime and 42% fewer inmates coming out of New York City. So obviously some of that has to do with policing and a lot of different factors. Now here's looking at Texas a little bit. This shows what has happened in our state from 2004 to 2008. And in 2005 was really an important year. Most people kind of look at 2007, which of course was, as you know, when January of 2007, the Legislative Budget Board said the state would need to build another 17,000 prison beds if we didn't change our policies, which of course we did greatly enhance, as I'll talk about later, community supervision and community-based alternatives. But in 2005, Texas also made a significant investment in the caseload reduction funding for probation departments. It was a lot of money. It actually saved twice as much as it cost, as I'll explain later. But here, you see in 2004, Texas had an incarceration rate per 100,000 residents of 704. That's declined 9.2%, actually more now. As our lieutenant governor notes, we're gaining 1,300 people every day from other states. But yet our prison population has flatlined and even declined slightly over these last several years. And then you see, most importantly, our crime rate declined 10.8% from 2004 to 2008. And today, this is as of this past year, Texas crime rate has reached its lowest level since 1973. So we've had good results for public safety. Now, another question we sometimes get is whether only the worst of the worst go to prison in Texas. Here are some statistics that I think you'll find to be useful. Two-thirds of entering inmates in Texas are there for a nonviolent offense. We have the nation's fourth highest incarceration rate. This was as of 2009, and this is adult incarceration rate. We actually have now, with all the juvenile reforms, a very low relative to other states' juvenile incarceration rate, at least at the state level. But and then also, we have 20,000 drug possession inmates in Texas. They have none in Oregon, so it's a big difference there. And then of those drug possession inmates we have in Texas, more than 5,000 are first-time felons. So that's a significant number. We do have people locked up for shoplifting, hot checks. Chairman Whitmire found out the other day there's over 350 people in our state prisons for prostitution, in our state jails. You know, we are pleased that serious violent sex offenders are serving longer than ever in Texas. They're serving about 90% of their sentences. And so we do believe in prioritizing our prison space for those that we're truly afraid of, not those we're just mad at. Now, here's a question we get when we kind of go around to other parts of the country. They say, well, did you just let out everybody early? How did you avoid building 17,000 prison beds? Well, of course, we did convert two juvenile facilities to prison, so it's not like we didn't create beds and we created the short-term treatment facilities. We expanded those. But we didn't let people out early. We didn't reduce sentences. The reforms in 2005 with the caseload reduction funding and then in 07 were primarily budgetary. And of course, that also means that it's so important as we look at the budget now to preserve and expand on what we've accomplished. But what we did was we expanded the capacity of those programs that offer less costly alternatives to incarceration. And, you know, obviously, if you're a judge or a prosecutor, the situation they faced was that there was waiting lists to get into these programs prior to the expansion in capacity in 2007. And in fact, the county would have to, if there was a waiting list for a drug treatment program or something, the county would have to, or an intermediate sanctions facility, keep that person in their county jail for months while that bed opens up. And of course, that means money out of the county's pockets, and they're not going to do it. They're going to, if that person is on probation, they're just going to go ahead and revoke them to prison for 5 or 10 years, which is going to cost a lot more than if that bed had been available or that program. And, you know, also this case is similar with drug courts or DWI courts. I know in Houston they still think they need at least another DWI court because there's just greater demand than there is supply. We did not shorten sentences. We did see an increase in the parole rate from about 27% to 31% since 2007, and that was primarily because the board is finding that more inmates have gone through treatment programs, because there was also these backlogs in our prison system, including two that are very important. The parole board, for maybe half of the inmates they released, they ordered that they complete a 6-month treatment program in prison. And there were months waiting lists for those programs. So they would have people that were in prison that were approved for parole that could not be released because they were waiting to get into the treatment program. There was a condition of release. And we had the backlog of people waiting months for a halfway house spot. And we cleared that out with the 2007 funding that expanded the in-prison treatment programs and the halfway house capacity. Now, here is what I referenced earlier concerning the caseload reduction funding for probation in 2005. That was an additional $55 million to strengthen probation supervision, and it was conditioned on the departments had to agree, not all departments took the money, that they would reduce their caseloads, they would use it to reduce caseloads, and they would implement graduated sanctions. And it's kind of like disciplining your child. It's each time a probationer misses an appointment, you don't just mark it down and wait till enough pile up and then revoke him to prison for 10 years. You intervene with a swift, sure, and commensurate sanction, increased reporting, but you respond. And of course, that's a lot easier to do if you have a manageable caseload. But each department was required to, in order to get this money, create a system of graduated sanctions and set a goal of 10% fewer revocations to prison. So what we found was, those departments that participated, which was most of the big departments in the major counties, they reduced their technical revocations by 16%. Those are revocations from probation to prison, not for a new crime, but for a rules violation, like missing appointments. And those that did not take the money increased technical revocations by 8%. So what I did was run and said, well, what if every department had just increased revocations by 8%? We didn't have this. That would have been $119 million for an additional 2,600 revocations. So the latest statistic that just came out from the Legislative Budget Board a few weeks ago, the Texas adult probation revocation rate has declined from 16.4% in 2005 to 14.7% in 2010. Now that's 1.7% difference. It doesn't sound like much, but over 170,000 probationers, that's thousands of fewer people being revoked to prison. So the story is similar on parole, the success we've seen there. That's been primarily administrative rather than a statutory or budgetary measure, but the parole division has made many improvements. For example, from 2007 to 2008, there were over 1,000 fewer parolees who committed a new offense and were revoked for rules violations. That's $137 million of savings. And, you know, again, they've reduced the parole caseloads. They've done instant drug testing. The parole chaplains that were eliminated in the 2003 budget cuts were restored in 2007. So we've improved. Project Rio received additional funding to place parolees in jobs. And a job is the best social program. Now, here's parole supervision, as I said, has added substance abuse treatment. So somebody comes in, they do the instant drug test, and if they test positive, they send them to treatment. And in fact, what the parole division has told me is now most of them admit to it. They don't even have to test them, whereas before it was a two-week delay. So there was an old sign at a California parole office that said, trail them, nail them, and jail them. That was their slogan. And instead, I think our parole division is now telling officers, yes, there's a surveillance and monitoring function that's important, but let's also help parolees succeed. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, conservatives, because I'm a conservative. Texas Public Policy Foundation is, as you know, a strong conservative organization. And sometimes people think, well, conservatives just want to lock them up and throw away the keys, and for some people that's appropriate. But we talk about getting criminal justice right and being tough and smart. And this was a quote, actually, from Ronald Reagan back in his State of the State address in 1971. And it's amazing how timely it is. But he said, our rehabilitation policies and improved parole system are attracting nationwide attention. That's true here. Fewer parolees are being returned to prison than at any time in our history. That's true. And our prison population is lower than any time since 1963. He was saying this in 1971. And, of course, several years after that, the tide kind of shifted to the lock them up and throw away the keys mentality, but I think we're kind of seeing a shift back, including among conservatives. And we're seeing a lot of governors kind of following Texas's lead. Governor Jindal in Louisiana held a news conference on January 20th to announce that he's pursuing reforms, some of which he's already implemented, more day reporting centers, improved reentry, work release. Jody Rell announced in 2009, the Republican governor of Connecticut, she was closing a prison because she said, it's not because we're letting people out, it's because probation's working better, fewer people are coming in, we don't need it anymore. And she said it's a indication of our success. And, of course, Governor Perry's remark back in his State of the State speech in 2007 that we have to rehabilitate nonviolent offenders so we spend less locking them up again. We've now seen, actually, just today, Nathan Deal holding a news conference in Georgia. The new governor there, who's a former prosecutor, his brother's actually a drug court judge. And Mitch Daniels in Indiana and Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, are all pushing reforms. And they're citing Texas as a model. So we've also seen nationally many conservative leaders speaking out. Our own Right on Crime Statement of Principles has been signed by Newt Gingrich, former drug czar William Bennett, Grover Norquist, former Attorney General Ed Meese. And so one of the things that we really talk about is creating incentives, and I'll talk about that more in a minute, both for offenders and for the correction system, and to move from a system that grows when it fails to one that rewards results. And that resonates, I think, because conservatives understand incentives affect behavior. Now, what about the public? Does the public just want more prisons? And the answer is no. And by the way, I'd like to recognize Senator Ellis. I think he stepped in here, and he's a great leader in the Senate on these issues. This was a poll done by the National Council on Crime and Delinquency and Zogby, which is a respected polling firm. But they asked voters what they think the most appropriate sentence for a nonviolent, non-sexual offender whose crime did not involve significant property loss, which is defined as less than $400. 77.5% said probation, restitution, community service, and or rehabilitation. Only 19% said prison or jail. Now, here's a poll that was actually in Texas by the Texas Lyceum, which many of you may be familiar with. They're a leadership group, nonpartisan. But this slide's a little difficult to read, but the question was, which of the following would be your first priority for maintaining or increasing funding during the next round of state budget negotiations? That is kind of, they did this poll several months ago. I always wonder why they said your priority for maintaining or increasing funding, considering nothing may be increased. But anyway, the first choice was health care for the elderly or the mentally ill and poor children. For 30%, that was the first choice. Then 27% for K-12, aid to local school districts to offset property tax reductions, 20%, which is kind of K-12, isn't it? And then higher ed, 13%, and then prisons was the last one on the list. Only 3% thought that would be their top priority, for maintaining or increased funding during the next round of state budget negotiations. So we're obviously pleased that there's a lot of discussion now among closing prisons, including the Sugar Land unit. So here's another question about what do offenders think when it comes to these things? Is prison the toughest penalty for offenders? And this answer is kind of may surprise many of you, but this slide is also rather difficult to read, but I can explain it. But what they did is they asked these inmates in Oklahoma, would you, based on, you know, compared to how many months in prison, either 8 or 12, what period of time would you be willing to do these alternatives instead of that? Which were day fine, work release, community service, day reporting, halfway house. And you can see most of them would have rather been in prison than have to work and pay restitution, child support, do these other sanctions. So I think sometimes we think we're, you know, getting back at people, but we may not really be having that effect. Now victims, this is very important to us. What if crime victims want is the best solution in their case? And this was a survey of burglary victims in Iowa. And they asked them what sanction they would most want for the offender. And some over 81% said restitution. And then the community service was a close second, fine. And you go all the way down the list, a short jail term is in there at 41% requested that compared to 81% for restitution. But then a prison sentence of a year or more, only 7% of the burglary victims in Iowa wanted that. So I think that's really important. And we've actually looked at the numbers in Texas. And last year, probationers in Texas paid $47 million in victim restitution. Those in prison in Texas paid less than $500,000 total in restitution, fines, and fees. And our probationers in Texas also did $64 million in, worth of community service hours last year. And
that is exactly what I said. And it's also important to mention that probationers in Texas pay half of their supervision costs in fees. The total cost is $241 per day, half of which is paid for by the state, which is about $1.30. Prison's over $50 now in Texas, according to the LBB estimate. And as you can see, prisoners pay almost nothing. Obviously, they're not able to work, and they're living off the taxpayers. Now, one of the reasons that we got to this whole growth in incarceration is there was this belief that nothing else works besides prison. And I think, fortunately, we've seen a lot of research over the last 10 or 20 years, as well as some technological developments that have found, particularly when it comes to nonviolent offenders, that there are things that work. Some of them work better than prison, and many of them are more cost-effective. One of my favorite studies was one out of Maryland, where they compared a similar group of nonviolent offenders. Some went into an evidence-based probation supervision program, and some went to prison. And there was actually 22% less recidivism among those that went to the evidence-based probation program. As many of you know, there's a lot of great studies on drug courts showing 34% less recidivism among those who go into drug courts. The Hawaii Hope Court is very similar to a drug court with regular testing and also weekend jail for noncompliance. That's reduced reoffending by two-thirds. There's also strong evidence on mental health courts, on GPS, where it reduced revocations among probationers in Florida by 89%, virtually eliminated absconding among probationers, which is a problem in Texas. Some of the things that we talk about evidence-based practices in probation supervision are discussed here, and they're important because we know that probation and parole revocations account for two-thirds of those coming into our prisons. And it's a matter of using sanctions and incentives, improving the use of risk needs assessments to match the right offender with the right program so you don't over-supervise an offender. And one thing we've seen in Texas is, this is very important, in 2009, well, every year that the Legislative Budget Board does their prison projections, they build in, based on population and demographic trends, a 6% increase in direct sentences to prison. That's what they assume will happen every year. But something funny happened in 2009. There was a 6% reduction in direct sentence commitments to Texas prisons. And frankly, we think, we don't know for sure, but we think that may be because judges and prosecutors have more confidence now in probation because of the things we've done to strengthen supervision. So it's really important to keep that in mind. Now, Texas Corrections is at a crossroads. We know we've accomplished quite a bit, but what do we do now? So I've had a chance to, and I'm sure you have, digest the budgets that are on the table, and there's kind of good news and bad news when it comes to corrections. As I alluded to earlier, the great news, and this is totally different from 2003, we're actually talking about closing both adult and juvenile lockups. Governor Perry, in his budget release last week, said we should close the Sugar Land Central Unit, which is
was appraised in 2006 for $30 million, has a taxable redeveloped value of $240 million. The mayor, the city, would like to close it. It was built in 1905. It cost 14% more to operate than other prisons. But that's excellent news. We also did see that the Senate budget has less severe cuts to probation and diversion programs, though still substantial reductions. The Senate adult probation cut is 12.7% versus 21.8%. In the House. And again, as I mentioned earlier, it's so important to remember, prison is $50.91 per day versus $1.30 for probation. And, you know, if you look at the corrections budget as a whole, the prisons are 85%. Probation and parole is 15%. There are 2 to 3 times as many people on probation and parole. So you can just kind of add it up. Now, there was some of the bad news in the House and Senate-based budgets is one of the ones I noticed is that the House budget cuts the parole board. And it says, as a result of those cuts, that they will process many fewer cases.
Like something like 70,000 instead of 90,000.
But somehow they'll still parole the same number of people. Now, if you and I can't look at don't have time to look at a parole file, are we going to grant parole? No, we're not. In fact, you know, what's interesting is the analysis that the LBB did of the 5% biennial budget reduction plan of TDCJ, most of which was ended up being exempted, including this. But they said if here, this is on page 4, that that basically that if the budget was reduced by $2.5 million for the Board of Pardons and Paroles, they forecast a 1% decrease in the parole approval rate. A 1% point decrease in the parole approval rate translates to 750 annual fewer paroles. So the LBB's already said that that's what will result from that. So clearly, the parole board already has very limited time to spend on every file they look at, and I think it's important that they be able to make those decisions. Obviously, as you saw, Takumi, which is the Texas Council on Offenders with Mental Impairments, was lost, I think, half or more of its funding in the House budget. And one of the things they do is those specialized caseloads and continuity of care for parolees as they're coming out of prison. We know if someone's mentally ill and they were on medications in prison, as many of our mentally ill inmates are, when they're released and go cold turkey from those medications, there's no follow-up. Then they're likely to be a danger to public safety. So this is a very, Takumi's actually been nationally recognized for the continuity of care, for making sure that these inmates who are mentally ill when they're released go to treatment, they follow up with them, make them take their medication, and so that they're not a danger to the public. As I alluded to earlier, the in-prison treatment programs are very important because, first of all, they helpfully reduce recidivism. I think there's evidence that they do. And also that they're often a condition of parole, and by the reducing the capacity of those in-prison treatment programs and the halfway house beds, both of which is in the draft budget, it could result in clogging up our prisons again with people that have been approved for parole but cannot be released. You know, you can't be released from prison on parole if you don't have a valid home plan. So if you don't have a place to live and there's no halfway house bed available because there's a waiting list like they were, you just stay in prison. Now, I'm going to end with a 12-step program, 12 steps to reduce corrections costs and protect public safety. And I don't know if you can read that picture, but it says cutting corrections, so here we go. Number one of the 12 is the incentive funding model that I alluded to earlier. And basically what this says is, and it's modeled after the juvenile measure that we did in 2009 through the budget. And it says that if a county would like to reduce their nonviolent commitments to prison, they can receive funds from the state. And the way that we're currently having it drafted is 35% would be upfront money that they would get, 35% of the state savings from fewer inmates that they would get to implement drug courts, evidence-based supervision, residential programs in the community. And then the other part, 15 or 20%, would be ongoing performance-based. And they only get that money if they reduce their recidivism, reoffending among probationers, increase, so that's about 15%. Then you get 5% if they increase the percent of probationers who are current on their restitution, and another 5% if they increase the percent that are employed among their probationers. So it's a combination of upfront money and performance-based ongoing money, and it's all a share of the savings to the state from sending fewer nonviolent offenders to prison. And it's voluntary with the counties.
So we did this with TYC on the juvenile budget. It didn't have the performance element directly.
It did say you have to submit performance measures. But what we did in the last session was the legislature cut TYC by $115 million based on there being fewer youths projected, and they took $47 million of that, gave it to the Juvenile Probation Commission to do this commitment reduction program. And it's been very successful. Every county, almost every county has participated, and every county that's participated has met their goal. We've seen juvenile crime continue to decline in the major metropolitan areas in the state during the last year since this was implemented,
and there's been a 36% decline in TYC commitments. So that is, I think, an excellent thing we can do this session. Another item is drug sentencing reform. This has been endorsed by the Texas Association of Business in their budget blueprint.
It was one of the five or six elements they highlighted in their news release, and was also referenced in a quote by Bill Hammond in the Dallas Morning News.
But what this says is first-time drug offenders would be sent to probation, treatment, drug courts, and this is only drug possession, not drug dealers, of course, and they could also be sent to a six-month substance abuse felony punishment facility, which is basically a prison with therapeutic group drug treatment. So it's still tough on these offenders,
but it's only first-time drug possession offenders. Anybody who has a prior offense other than a fine-only traffic misdemeanor
would not be eligible.
And if the judge makes written findings that are a danger to public safety, they can still send them to prison for what would be third-degree drug possession, could be up to 10 years if they make a written finding. This guy's a gang leader, he's a danger to public safety.
So it's got the appropriate, narrowly crafted language, I believe.
And it did pass the Senate in 2007.
Now, I'll go through these a little more quickly here. There's a legislative budget board recommendation for a supervised reentry period for prison inmates that are currently flat discharged.
Now, this is a major problem. We had Pat Lykos, the DA from Harris County, in our policy orientation. He said, all these people get flat discharged. They're dropped at 1212 Main Street in downtown Houston, and there's gangs waiting for them. There's no supervision, no reentry.
And what this bill would say is there'd be a reentry period of 9 months, where they would have some supervision.
We have tens of thousands of people that are being flat discharged, both from the prisons and the state jails. This bill wouldn't actually deal with the state jail aspect, but it would deal with those that are flat discharged from prison with a supervised reentry period. Now, it would be released a little early for that period, and so that's where the budget savings come. But I believe we would have a recidivism reduction through the supervision and reentry that would more than offset the fact that we're releasing people a few months early.
I think that's... The
evidence clearly shows that it's better to have that transition where we know where these people are. And in the counties, it's a big problem for them. You know, Tarrant County set up a whole office, just with one person in it, but a whole office to deal with the flat discharges, because they're like, we don't even know who these people are coming into our community that are not on parole, they're just flat discharged.
And we need our law enforcement to know where they are, we need to know who these people are, and have them have some supervision. Now, another related bill is earned time for state jail felons with a reentry period. As you know,
state jail felons is flat time up to 2 years. There's no good time. There's no credit for good behavior like there is in prisons for completing programs.
So this would provide an incentive for those state jail felons where they could earn a small amount of time off their sentence or off the prison part of their sentence and then go on to a supervised period instead of being flat discharged.
Now, if you look at the LBB recidivism numbers that just came out, you'll see our state jail recidivism rate is close to 60%. It's much higher than our prison recidivism rate. And these are the lowest level. These are less than a gram of drugs, hot checks.
And these are the people that, if they have that supervised reentry period, I believe we could drive down the recidivism and save money. Expanding geriatric parole, that's been recommended by the Legislative Budget Board. It was also part of the Texas Conservative Coalition blueprint for a balanced budget.
We know there's many people, this came up at the appropriations hearing a few days ago, that are paraplegic, that are terminally ill, that cannot pose a threat to anybody. They're dying in prison today because our guidelines for geriatric parole are too stringent. There's something in there about being within 6 months of death. Unfortunately, none of us know when we're within 6 months of death.
And we've got 4,400 inmates who are 61 and older.
Now, I'm not saying they should all be released. We need to have risk assessment and a screening process. But some of them could be put into nursing homes where they would be on Medicaid, where the federal government would be picking up most of their health care costs. We have inmates that are costing us $1 million a year just in health care costs.
That's all coming out of GR. So we can address that. We've also, on the operational side, suggested reducing the unnecessary use of solitary confinement. particularly for those inmates who have not committed
disciplinary violations. We are putting inmates in solitary confinement, about 9,000 are in there, who are just suspected gang members. And there's other things we could do with them to control them in prison. Now, we need solitary confinement for those that have disciplinary problems that present a danger to guards and staff, but I believe this is something that we can address that can safely be done. In fact, in Mississippi, Haley Barber closed 80% of their Supermax unit, which is solitary confinement. They've not had any problems since he's done that in Michigan. Jennifer Granholm reduced solitary confinement. She was able to close a whole prison just by consolidating some inmates. And there's other ways to manage through incentives and sanctions some of these folks in prison. So that's something we need to look at. Obviously, I know a lot of folks are looking across agencies at co-payments for state employees for health insurance. That's something those of us who work in the private sector mostly already have to do. Now, a few more things. We are also looking, Senator Whitmire had a bill in 2007 to pass the Senate that said that if you're on parole and you're not a serious violent or sex offender and you commit a technical violation or a nonviolent misdemeanor, you would go to an intermediate sanctions facility. And the bill extended the time that you could go, I think, to 180 or 360 days,
so it wouldn't be just 90 days, it would be a longer period. But that bill was projected to save $150 million over 5 years.
Not quite as much as the drug sentencing reform bill I mentioned earlier that would save $500 million over 5 years,
but still a large savings, and I believe that Whitmire is planning to move forward with that bill again.
And again, these are people that have violated the rules on parole but have not committed a new felony, and they would still be incarcerated just for a shorter period.
Now, these are a couple other ideas here. One of the problems that we do have on probation is absconding, and we've suggested that we institute an incentive grant program where probation departments would receive funds for electronic monitoring in exchange for agreeing to reduce revocations of absconders who are not suspected of a new crime.
We have some exciting technologies. There's something called crime scene correlation with GPS, where the police know, the probation department knows if that person was at a crime scene the night before, because it would go off and it would show up on their screen. And also they would know if they weren't there, which is also important. But sometimes probationers or parolees get questioned about crimes they didn't commit.
I know many of you are looking at the prison-based health care, looking at competitive bidding for some of the unit-based care. But we do need to make sure we attend to not just cost, but also quality. The last thing we want is the federal court supervising our health care in prison like they do in California. Tremendously expensive.
California spends twice as much as we do on prison health care with less results, and now they're in federal court.
Now, another one is reinstituting mandatory supervision. As many of you know, back in 1995,
we moved from mandatory supervision to discretionary mandatory supervision.
And what we're suggesting is that some of the lowest level inmates, the drug possession offenders without a prior felony, that those could be mandatory supervision, that they, when they reach a certain time based on good behavior in prison, they would be released, and we would have proven reentry approaches with some of those savings,
such as reentry drug courts, which are greatly reducing recidivism in Dallas. And the last one of our 12-step program, it's about time we did talk about juvenile justice for a second. And as many of you know, there's going to be a bill filed, the Sunset Bill, to consolidate our two juvenile agencies, the Texas Youth Commission and Texas Juvenile Probation Commission.
And what I believe this bill will reflect and what we support is
having state institutions still for those capital offenders, like they are in Giddings, which is an excellent program,
very low recidivism for the capital offenders program in Giddings, about 5%, and the determinately sentenced youth, which are, again, are very serious crimes, not capital crimes,
but we would still have state institutions for those youths,
but the remaining youths would go back to the counties with money
attached to them. That's very important.
But it doesn't have to be the same amount we're spending to keep those kids at TYC, those non-capital, non-determinate sentences. The new LBB cost estimates, TYC is now $359 per day per youth.
That comes out to about $125,000 a year.
That's a lot of money.
The most expensive county facility of the local county juvenile facilities is about $150 a day. So there's a big gap there. We can make the counties whole.
We can still save a lot of money. And, of course, we can eliminate the duplicative offices. We have juvenile parole offices in our major metropolitan areas that, when we combine these agencies, can be combined with juvenile probation.
So we don't need the duplicative offices. Well, I will wrap up now, and I want to thank you for bearing with me, and I think that as you can see in this room, there's people of all different ideological backgrounds coming together to find solutions that will promote public safety and control cost to taxpayers and make sure victims get restitution. I know there's a lot of consternation around the Capitol and outside of the Capitol about the challenges we face this session, but I think it's also an opportunity to do some of the things that we can really improve our criminal justice system and be both tough and smart. So thank you, and I'll turn it over to Anna now, and I'm sure we'd be glad to take questions after her presentation.
Thank you, Mark. You're wonderful. So, Mark is absolutely right. This is a session for a lot of opportunities, and as you can see, there's a lot of people from a wide range of communities. There's restorative justice. There's, you know, Jody Smith. Where are you, Jody? Jody's with the Texas Care for Children, and she works with a lot of the juvenile justice advocates. There's Jim Becky over there in the back, who brought you a very good, you know, brochure on how his agency actually has a positive impact on counties on a daily basis, which is really important. And there's Carrie Wellebob, I mean, the Judge Cosper there, and our Sheriff, you know, Hamilton there from Travis County. I mean, there's just a lot of people here who really want to do the right thing. And there's already a lot of solutions that have been shopped around that that basically we're going to ask everybody to join forces and help. And there's Reese Owens from the Parole Board, so we really appreciate Reese. So one of the things that I wanted to point out is that there's one of the policy recommendations that Mark was talking about in terms of the doing the same thing that was happening with the juveniles to with the adult system. There's a bill already that's going to be filed. Amy, where, with Corona's office, where's she at? Did she walk out already? She walked. Okay. Well, help her out, because that bill is going to be filed by Senator Corona, and it's actually also looking at helping out with the community justice plans, and it's not making it mandatory. It's making it permissive. If people want to join in, they can. In terms of the probation departments, they can. If they don't, they don't. And it also changes the date of the community justice plans when they're supposed to be submitted. That is going to be very helpful to people in the field that, you know, we keep on hearing from probation departments. So Amy, whenever she comes in, you know, look her up and help her out. She also, Senator Corona also has a bill that is going to be focusing on educational components for the judiciary, for defense attorneys, for prosecutors on mental health, as well as substance abuse. Shannon is like, But you know what? Here's the thing. The dialogue, you have to have a bill so that the dialogue can happen and people can start talking about how do we make sure that people who suffer from mental health, you know, mental illness do not end up in our county jails or in our prisons. How do we make sure that people who suffer from substance abuse do not, you know, the last resort, you know, we cannot continue to send people over and over and over into our criminal justice system at $50.79 a day when they can be better and more effectively handled in the community. And for that bill, that's going to be Brandon Dudley from Senator Ellis's office and Scott Eller, so help them out on the Texas Business Association's recommendation on the substance abuse items. And Anise from Representative Allen's office has three beautiful pieces of legislation that hopefully, you know, wave your hand right over there, you know, help her out too. Those are going to be three really good policy recommendations that they're going to be filing soon. And on the juvenile justice stopping the school-to-prison pipeline, there's Representative Wally's office right over there. Wave your hand. Those are some really good policies. So you see, a lot of these solutions we're going to put in one page, and we're going to be sending it out your way. And what we're asking for everyone is to think about why we are promoting these policies. I mean, Sylvester Turner has a really good bill on positive incentives for people who complete probation and who are really doing good. I don't know if is Sylvester's office here. All right, so help out Allison Brock and Sylvester's office on that bill. So the list goes on, and we will be distributing it to all of you. On the back, we did an analysis of HB1, which is the cuts that it's going to have on the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, who's here. Thank you so much for being here. Indigent defense costs with Jim Becky, juvenile, as well as probation. So here's the whole analysis of how a lot of the cuts that are going to happen are going to roll back all of the progress that Mark Levin just explained, and how we really need to be smart about how those cuts are going to have a horrible impact in our communities. Community supervision is going to suffer, parole is going to suffer, You know, reentry services, mental health, I mean, you name it. Anything that actually helps people improve their lives is in danger of being cut. And so there's a lot of recommendations. A lot of the bill ideas that we have, a percentage of the savings that are going to be produced are going to be tailored and are going to be used for continuation of funding for diversions and substance abuse and programs. So we're not just saying pass all of these bills, we're going to save millions and millions and millions of dollars. We're also saying use a percentage of those savings to reinvest in what's really helping our community, so that when the members go back to their districts, you're saying, you know, we're not just putting all these people out here without any assistance. We actually are being smart, and we're reinvesting them on reentry and parole, on treatment, and so forth. So you have my PowerPoint. Oh, that's a recorder.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't have remote, but you could just use this to advance the items here.
Oh, thank you. So Mark has already covered a lot of the items that we were talking about. And I'm sure he told you that, you know, Texas saved $2 billion because of the wonderful work, bipartisan, by Representative Jerry Madden, and we want to thank, you know, his office for helping us with this room. And Representative Neistat, thank you so much for, you know, distributing the flyer to everybody. Really appreciate it. So, I mean, the thing is that we have seen public safety, you know, positive outcomes in terms of public safety, positive outcomes in terms of money. So that's the message that everybody needs to, you know, realize, is that when everything is said and done, we can be using a lot of that money for a lot of things to meet the needs of our state. And so if we reinvest in things that are actually working, you know, it helps every facet of society. So let's just keep on doing that. I'm just going to keep on going, because Mark has already talked about how probation is actually only costing the state $1.24. You know, the other is covered by probationer fees, but really what it's costing the state is, right, Carrie, it's $1.24 per probationer. So when you think about it, and when you tell your member, when they're making those decisions, hey, boss, remember, probation is $1.24 versus prison cost, $50.79. The same thing with parole. You know, parole is $3.74 versus, you know, $50.79. I mean, come on. We don't have them. This is really important right here. Every single session, there's a bazillion enhancements. Shannon can talk to you a little bit about that. In fact, he is going to talk about the enhancements and all the enhancements that are filed in the next committee at 3:30. But basically, when you think about creating new crimes, enhancing what's already there, you have to think about two things. Is this really going to stop the criminal behavior? Is this bill really going to stop the criminal behavior? And how much money is it going to cost, not just the state, but the counties? A lot of times, counties are left, you know, basically paying the bill for a lot of policies with good intentions. You know, you see a newspaper article, you see a constituent, they have a concern, something happened, and so the first thing that comes out is an enhancement. So when everything is said and done, we have to think about what is actually going to meet that needs of the constituent. That constituent wants the criminal activity to stop. They don't just want us to waste money. They don't want us, in fact, they don't want us to waste money. They just want, they want their restitution. They want their property back. They want the criminal activities to stop. And the National Institute of Corrections has said that treatment does that, cognitive thinking programming does that, and actually punishment increases criminal behavior slightly, you know. So that's just something that, you know, we have to really pay attention. And I know it's a challenge. So if you have an enhancement, if you have a bill like that, come to us. I mean, there's the whole TCJC and Mark Levin, you know, staff here. We don't just want to, you know, testify against your bill. We actually want to give you some type of solution so that the needs of your constituents can be addressed and so the criminal behavior can stop. So just an FYI on that. So, you know what the LBB projections say. We make all these cuts, we're going to be back, we're going to have to start building prisons. We already know that. What's going to happen? Prisons fill up. Who's going to pay for it? Your constituents are going to pay for it. We're going to pay for it. The kids are going to pay for it. Why? Because all the cuts are happening or impacting everybody else. And so, really, what are we getting for the investment, quote-unquote, on just putting people behind bars? Not enough. So, that's the whole shift. We cannot cut. So one of the things that we want to do is, since most of the money that goes in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice budget goes towards the actual containment of people, because, you know, they have buildings and they have to contain them, and that costs a lot of money. So the most amount of money goes to that instead of things that are actually making a lot of sense. So one of the things that we want to do, and that we're really happy about, we're really happy to see the closure of the Sugarland facility, what Mark was talking about. But it's not just about closing the facility. It's about how about using some of that money that can be created from the revenue of closing that facility and reinvesting some of that money on programs like on parole and on treatment, on reentry. So what we want to think about is strategies that not just, you know, let's just go ahead and close down all these facilities. Fine, you're going to close them down, but that money is just going to go into the hole, into the, you know, that big black hole where, you know, there's just, we have a budget shortfall. So that's going to go there. So what we need to do is just use some of that money and appropriate it where it actually makes sense and it matters. The other thing is that we have to think about the, you know, we already talked about the unfunded mandates to the counties, and one of those things is the Task Force on Indigent Defense. The reason why I really want to focus on this is because, unlike anything else, people have a constitutional right to an attorney. This isn't a program. This is a constitutional right. So if you have a constitutional right to an attorney, unless you remove jail time from a specific crime, if you're indigent, you have to get an attorney. Okay? And as Andrea Marsh in the back will tell you, if you don't, you will be sued. And she has plenty of experience on that. She can talk to you about how counties will be sued if, you know, if there's potential cuts. But the bottom line is that we have to think about what is constitutional required, and we have to make sure that people have the right to representation. And counties right now are really struggling, and Judge Keller can, you know, did an amazing job downstairs explaining why that we have to stop that. Again, enhancements, new crimes. Let's put a little moratorium on that. Let's think about the impact that it's going to have in terms of our pockets. And obviously, diverting people away from prison, strengthening effective community supervision, and encouraging behavior. This is really important. For every one sanction, you need at least four, you know, you're doing a great job. People are human beings. People want to also know that they're doing a good job. If they're just told, you did bad, you did bad, you did bad, you did bad, you know, you kind of lose that hope, and people start feeling, well, you know, what is it for me? Why am I going to continue to do a good job? So you want to create incentives so that people can continue to do a good job. And Amy just walked in, and I was actually telling them about two of the bills that I'm hoping that they're going to help you out. So that's Amy right there. So that's what we want to do. We want to reward probationers. We want to reward parolees. We want to make sure that we help out as many of the judges and prosecutors' defense with evidence-based practices. We want to make sure that that, you know, there's a couple of bills. One of them is the street time. There's no really good incentive for people on parole to do really well. So we're kind of tweaking. We're examining how people who are on parole, how can we really incentivize good behavior for them, which is really going to help out overall. I mean, we had a really good discussion with Judge Lykos, and one of the things that she said in TBPF's last meeting was, when people exit prison, the people that are welcoming them are not the social workers, are not the substance abuse, you know, providers. They're, you know, they're the gangs and the people that are there to recruit them. And when you have a lot of convictions and you have a record, it's really difficult for you to really get out of that cycle. So if you can't find the housing, you can't find the job, what are you left with? You're left with the same life that drove you into the system at our cost. So what we want to do is try to figure out policies that are going to create those incentives for good behavior and are going to reduce the victims and hopefully get people to pay, you know, family restitution and all of that, you know, child support, all of the stuff to take care of their families. So one of the, you know, Mark already touched on this, on the removal of discretionary mandatory supervision, we're looking at a savings of $300,000 a day. So that's something to think about. That's something to think about. So those are some of the policy recommendations that we have that are going to save money. We are about to launch our policy primers that are broken down into various issues. If you want them on Word so that you can copy and paste the talking points and give them to your members, you're more than welcome. Whatever talking points you need from us, we'll give them to you. Whatever stats, whatever data, anything that we can find, we are here to service you. And we're going to have our first policy primer is going to be on all the alternatives to incarceration. A lot of these are already going to have bills So we're just waiting for like the bill numbers so that when we go to your offices, we can tell you, here's the bill numbers. Please be an author. Please be a joint author. Or at least don't vote against it. You know, tell your boss it's a good bill. It's going to save money. It's going to increase public safety. So that one is going to come out fairly soon. That's the purpose of that policy primer, is to maintain that savings and to maintain that public safety. We also have a lot of strategies that are going to help counties. County jails are overly burdened, and we need to help them to make sure that the county jail population is being, is being assisted. So that's one of the things. And there's other alternatives. There's Joe Cassandra over there. We actually went to Dallas to check out this program. It's called the Dallas Prostitution Diversion Initiative, that was created by law enforcement in Dallas County. That's really helping out these women get out of the life of prostitution, and it's been an amazing program. And that's something that we want to look at and want to tweak to make sure that women and men, who are in that line of work, get out of that line of work and are able to give back to their families in a way that is not going to, just get out of that line of work. But and it's a beautiful program from the police, actually. So that's something that we're going to be looking at. Part two is going to be on reentry infrastructure, and we have a lot of people from the reentry community who are helping us. There's the Austin Travis Reentry Roundtable. There's the San Antonio Reentry Roundtable. There's BEAR. There's some people from Houston. I mean, there's a wide range of people who really want to reduce barriers to reentry that are not going to cost the state any money and that are really going to help out. And of course, there's the front-end strategies to reduce the jail population in an effective way and help out in terms of indigent defense. And finally, we're going to have our juvenile justice framework. Whatever happens with our juvenile justice system for next session, two things have to happen. The money and the rights must follow the kids. The money and the rights must follow the kids. And that's just very important. We have an opportunity with this new system. It's going to happen. I mean, it's going to be a sunset bill, but we have to make sure that those kids are being protected, that the counties have the resources necessary to meet the needs of those kids, because if you help the kids, you're going to see a lot of savings in terms of the adult system later on. So that's what we have. And I know that's a lot of information. And really, I just want to thank all of you for making it here. But I really hope that when you look at the budget, when your bosses look at the budget, make sure that you see the agencies in a way that, okay, how is cutting the Texas Commission on Jail Standards really going to help us? You know, it's not going to help us. Counties are going to get sued if they go away. How is cutting indigent defense funds from the Task Force on Indigent Defense going to help us? It's not. Andrew Marsh will tell you there will be lawsuits if that happens. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's going to be harmful. How is probation, parole, treatment, how are those cuts really going to help us? They're not. They're not going to help us. So we're going to give you some solutions in terms of those alternatives. You know, are we going to, why cut juvenile probation? You know, how is that going to fit into this new grand scheme of things? So those are just some foods for thought. I know it's a lot of information. But again, we're here. There's Erica from our office. There's Leah. There's Chris. And there's Travis. And I'm sure they're outside. You know, they're right there. So we're one phone call away. We have Jane. We have Victor. Where's Victor at? All right. And we have amazing coalition partners. There's Yanez from the NAACP. I mean, it's a lot of people, Restorative Justice Ministries, who really want to help out. And Shannon, you know, I always try to go to Shannon and ask him, what do you think about this? He'll tell me, this is what I think about it. So that's all we have. Do you have any questions? Yes, sir.
You mentioned something about change in solitary confinement for offenders that are in TDCJ. Are we talking pre-hearing detention? Are we talking transient offenders? And in what way would it change? Like, where would they go? Would it change the policies that are in place?
Well, what I'm talking about is those at TDCJ, not county jails. There's about 9,000 in solitary confinement, administrative segregation, which is actually separate from the 2,000 or so that are in safekeeping, which are people like police officers that they're protecting from other inmates. But this 9,000 in solitary confinement or administrative segregation, the idea is simply to say, looking at those that have not committed disciplinaries in prison, such as, harming other inmates or staff, that rather than just put them into solitary confinement automatically because they're a suspected gang member, create another approach. Obviously, the agency can determine which inmate that person shares a cell with. They can have sanctions for good behavior or bad behavior. There's other ways to control conduct. Now, if those don't work, I'm not opposed to using solitary confinement, certainly. You know, Missouri has a great model on this called the Parallel Universe. There's a fabulous report by the National Institute of Corrections on it, and Arizona's implemented it. There was an article in the Tucson paper and a report by corrections researchers on the Arizona. But the reason it's called Parallel Universe is the theory is that one of the problems with prisons historically is that it's unlike the free world in a capitalist society. One's behavior is often totally uncorrelated with one's rewards or one's conditions. And so the idea of the parallel universe is to make that connection so that, for example, in Arizona, those inmates who are very well behaved get better food, they get a later curfew, and so forth. And so you can use these sanctions and incentives to control conduct on most inmates. You can also ensure that, you know, people from rival gangs aren't in the same cell. I mean, you can do things. You don't have to just have solitary confinement. It's convenient, perhaps, for the agency, but it is more costly because it means, of course, as I said, in Mississippi, they were able to reduce it by 80%. In Missouri, in Michigan, they closed a whole prison just because they were able to consolidate by reducing the number of inmates who had their own cells through the reduction of solitary confinement. So I think it's something that is very doable, and we're not necessarily suggesting there be an arbitrary cap, but we could, for example, say that if you don't have a disciplinaries in prison, that you don't go into solitary confinement. This is for people who have demonstrated that they cannot function in the general population of the prisons.
I think your definition of solitary confinement and administrative segregation, those are two separate issues, and there's two separate divisions in that. When you keep trying to say solitary confinement, that's completely different than administrative segregation, because the gang related is two separate issues. And when you keep confusing those, people think it's all solitary confinement. It's not. There's two distinct classifications in the corrections facility for that.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. And so the numbers may be a bit different. I think what I'm referring to is those people that are basically in a single cell for 23 hours a day with no programming and so forth. And one of the concerns I have is actually that there are people that are released straight from solitary confinement, whether that's on parole or because they've served out their whole sentence. But I certainly appreciate the clarification, because we're not talking about the administrative segregation that doesn't involve solitary confinement.
I just had a question. You know, with Texas, y'all mentioned that Texas had the fourth highest incarceration rate, and then you also mentioned there are actually people who have been approved for parole but have no place to go. And from my general understanding is that most of our prison and, you know, county facilities are up to capacity, even our halfway houses. So I just wanted to find out, if they were closing the Sugar Land prison, you know, how are they doing that?
Well, we're under capacity a little. I mean,
a little bit, yeah. We were under more than we were now several months ago, but we are relatively close. I mean, TDCJ prefers to be operating not at 100% of capacity for obvious reasons. They have to move inmates around for programs and things like that. So,
but you bring up a really good point, and I'm sorry, my friend, because this is why this is so important when we think about there's the budget, and then there's also all of these policy recommendations that we have to look at we can't solve everything through the budget, especially now in this session. It's just not going to happen. So we have to be responsible about reducing the numbers through policy as well. You can't just say, you know, we're going to close down this stuff. That's why we have, you know, that's why your boss has, you know, the probation incentive thing, because that's going to reduce the number of people ending up on the front end. That's why, you know, there's the drug treatment versus prison one, because that's going to reduce the number of people going in. And also on the parole side, that's why you have a lot of the other bills, Representative, Alma Allen, Allen is going to be doing. So it's going to take all of these moving parts, and that's why we got to get, we got to get these hearings going, and we got to get these bills moving. And when you do it, the fiscal note analysis, and you start seeing savings, that's our hope, so that the prison system can see, okay, wow, we have this huge reduction of people, so that we can potentially close down more prisons and really focus on community-based treatment for the people that need it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on it. I mean, the agency believes correctly, I think, I assume they're right about this, that, you know, they can accommodate those inmates at Sugarland and other facilities. But I would, as Anna said, if you want to talk about closing, many facilities, not just a couple, then you really have to do some of the policy initiatives that we talked about.
You mentioned closing down the Sugar Land facility, the central unit, which probably has, what, 1,000 G1 and G2 offenders?
It's not quite full. I've got the spreadsheet that shows like the, how many are actually in each unit. It's like 700 or 800, yeah.
But roughly 1,000 G1 and G2 offenders, which is basically minimum security. If they shut that unit down and maybe other units that are in the area, those offenders would then have to be transferred to maximum security prisons and fill beds that could be otherwise used for maximum security offenders. Has there been a study to basically look at the cost effectiveness of moving those offenders to maximum security?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, Senator Whitmire has long made the point that we've got more maximum security beds than we really need, and that has to do with the way things were constructed. But, you know, I think you can create more trustee camps, for example, which have probably a lower operating cost. One of the kind of interesting questions is we have the operating costs for each unit, but we don't have the operating costs for a trustee camp versus solitary confinement, for example. I mean, those are two ends of the spectrum. But my guess is you could create additional trustee camps that would have a lower per day operating cost for the lower classification inmates, which would be far cheaper than keeping the Sugar Land unit.
And in terms of the cost analysis, TDCJ does not have an incentive to close down any facility because, again, whatever savings comes out of closing that, it's going to cost them some money to close down a facility. I think there's a detergent factory there in Sugar Land.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're going to have to find somewhere else to make the, you know, soap and stuff. So the thing is that if you think about it, we, you know, that's not a good incentive. If we have to create incentives for them to think outside of the box. And one way of doing that is to make sure that whatever savings comes out of those type of, you know, strategies that are being looked at, not just in Texas, but, you know, with TYC and are being looked at, you know, nationwide, we have to take that portion or some portion of that money and reinvest it on options that judges are going to need, on options that people are going to need to be able to target criminal behavior. Yes, sir.
Quick question. Has the state thought about moving towards assessments, you know, like statewide assessment placements, you know, when you think, especially for the juvenile justice system, and we talk about incentives, it's now easy for a judge to say, our probation department, to say, well, we won't do anything with this youth, we hope to meet our incentives, we'll maybe bring some more money into the county. You know, Florida uses the PACT, Positive Assessment Change Tool, that says, when the youth enters into the system, this is the type of treatment they need. Have we thought about anything like that?
Well, we certainly have, and we've certainly advocated for it. And TDCJ right now and CJAD is looking at an assessment. For the adults part, TDCJ and CJAD is looking at an assessment for probation. We're hoping that that's going to take place in terms of the parole at some point. Ooh, wouldn't that be fun? And then hopefully pretrial at some point so that it can be kind of like a seamless sort of, you know, you do assessment, then placement, then follow-up based on that. So that's going to happen. I mean, we've wanted to do bills that mandate assessment right then and there. We're a little hesitant in terms of how much money that would cost the counties and how much money in this budget reality. But in terms of probation, I mean, that's something that we haven't, you know, we've always said assessment first. And you bring up a really good point, because how are you if you just look at the crime, if you just look at why people are there for the crime, that doesn't tell you much. That doesn't really tell you, you know, where they are in terms of do they need substance abuse treatment, do they need mental. The criminogenic indicators, the indicators that will tell you the likelihood of people committing or not committing crime, are they low, medium, high risk? So you bring up a really good point.
That's one of the things that we've noticed with juvenile offenders is when we're committing in the TYC, what we've done now is we say, okay, we're not going to treat the youth, we're going to treat the crime.
Right.
Saying only felony offenders can be committed in TYC.
Well, and I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of room for a lot of that in this whole, restructuring and all of this stuff. I mean, we were one of the advocacy groups that were like, you know, don't send misdemeanors to TYC. And, you know, the sky didn't fall down, so I do have to say that, you know. People were a little bit like, oh my gosh, you know. But you bring up a really good point, is that people have to know where they are and they have to use evidence-based practices, and with that requires assessment.
Well, and I will say the sunset bill for the juvenile system last session required the Juvenile Probation Commission to promulgate a risk assessment instrument, and they did. And in fact, it's verified in that they tested it to make sure retroactively that it accurately predicted who was low, medium, and high risk. And they also did a separate one for females because it's been shown female youths have different pathways and different indicators and risk factors. So, I think it's something we need to look at. You know, one of the things you could actually save money through this because you find you may have a first-time drunk driver who is on probation and, you know, may never have had any other offenses. You know, if you go down the risk factors, some of them are how long are they living in the community? They have a family. They have all these things. Making him come to the probation office once a week is a waste of money. The guy is extremely low risk, and in fact, if somebody's got to leave their job for an hour during the day to go to the probation office, that actually may be putting you on a higher risk. So it helps you make sure you're allocating your supervision resources wisely among your offenders, and also you can have lower caseloads for people that are higher risk, both on probation and parole. So to me, it's an efficiency measure. I think more and more adult probation departments are using validated risk assessments. There's one called the Ohio Risk Assessment System that Professor Latessa, and that has all five stages, pretrial to parole and reentry, and it's in the public domain, so it's free for any department that wants to use it.
How's everyone feeling? I know it's a lot of information.
Well, we're originally going to have refreshments, but we got moved to the committee room, so the members
they're
going to
be good, too.
I told myself I wasn't going to say anything, but I mean, piggyback what you're talking about, this has a bit of lack of effective policy reform ideas in this building. It's why we're at it, and a lack of political will. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's going to take everybody in this room, everybody you all know, to really make a push to get this stuff back. We've been fighting these battles for
long.
Who knows how long, and I mean, you know, Pete, you can speak to that better than I can.
Because of my age.
I mean, you really got to push this forward. This is, within this disaster comes a unique opportunity to get this done.
And this is so, I mean, we can get this, we can make something happen this session. We are really happy with all the meetings that we've had with the members of the Corrections Committee. They're really open. They're really we're just really looking forward to it. I mean, and you have, you know, veterans here like Kelvin over here, you know, who's been doing all this, you know, reentry work for a long, long time. You know, we're going to need to help him. Again, Brandon, we're going to need to help him. I mean, you have experts that have been following this for years. Michelle Deitch is here. I mean, you have a lot of people who are here as a resource, and now it's time to just get it going. Let's just do it. And again, we're going to make a list of all the bills. As soon as we get the bill numbers, we're going to distribute them, and then we're just going to start shopping for authors and authors and joint authors and a definitely yes, you know, when it comes down to voting. So we need your help, and if you see anything that you want our feedback on in terms of, we don't have all the solutions. I mean, your offices know a lot of the good stuff. You know your community. You know what you want. So also reach out to us. If we get behind a bill, I mean, we will humbly help you. We'll do the talking points, the fact sheets, try to get you witnesses. We're here. You know, we're here for you. You know, and we want to thank the practitioners in the field who are really doing this stuff. And we have to be cognizant of that. So, you know, Sheriff, you know, Hamilton there will tell you that a lot of this stuff will get back down to his level, and people don't really think about the county ramifications that some of these stuff happens, and we got to start thinking about them too.
Well, are there any other questions? If not, we'll wind up, and thank you all for coming.
Yeah, thank you very much. Don't forget to take these budget analysis, task percentage into defense information. Here's my office.
Oh.
Oh, look, we're going to take a picture, Mark.
Did you take any during the briefing too?
I tried to take some. The problem is the camera doesn't exactly get everything.
Well, just send me whatever ones come out, and I can put them on Facebook.